This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. Welcome back to the Relic Radio Show. We have another set of old-time radio for you, starting off with Theater 5. From October 16th, 1964, we'll hear The Captive Spirit. Then It's Incredible But True and Goodbye, Mr. Bathurst. Finally, we'll hear Obsession, an episode titled The Solitary Genius, which aired sometime in 1952.
I couldn't believe it. The big iron gate was open. I walked to it and stood there. Stood on the edge of two worlds. The one behind me was the only one I really knew. But the world beyond the gate was the world of other people. If I entered it, what would he do? What would be my punishment? You'll hear my story as you listen to The Captive Spirit on Theater 5.
Back, Mr. Prescott. I don't care how many men you have to hire or how much it costs. I want her back.
Mr. Bishop, you say her name is Caroline.
That's right.
And what about this photograph?
It's the perfect likeness.
When was this picture taken?
A few months ago.
Mr. Bishop, how old is your daughter?
I don't see what that has to do with it.
Well, I mean, if she's still a minor, then legally...
Legally? What does the law know about these things? Besides, you're a private investigator, aren't you?
Well, I'm afraid you may have the wrong idea about private investigators, Mr. Bishop. We don't work against the law.
Well, I'm not asking you to break any laws, Mr. Prescott. My daughter is missing. I simply want you to find her and bring her back to me.
Well, did she leave this house of her own accord, or did she run away with some guy?
No. Caroline doesn't know any men.
She could have met a young man at school.
No, she has never gone to school. It was her mother's wish that she be educated here at home.
I see. That oil painting on the wall...
Oh, that's Caroline's mother, my wife.
She's a very beautiful woman.
Yes, she passed away when Caroline was only 7.
Oh. Mr. Bishop, how long has your daughter been missing?
I noticed that she was gone about 7 this morning.
It's only 5 hours ago, not very long. She might have...
Now, Mr. Prescott, I would hardly have asked you to drive here from the city if I weren't quite sure that my daughter is missing. She took a suitcase and some clothing with her.
Have you considered the possibility of kidnapping?
No, I'm sure she wasn't kidnapped.
Oh, then in your opinion, she ran away.
Yes.
You seem quite definite about that.
Mr. Prescott, this isn't the first...
Oh. Oh, it's happened before.
Yes.
How often?
I fail to see why all these questions are necessary.
Mr. Bishop, if I'm to look for your daughter, it certainly won't do any harm to learn all I can.
But while you're asking these questions, heaven knows what may be happening to her.
Why didn't you bring the police into this?
Because I'd like to avoid gossip and publicity. Also, I want this to be handled discreetly. I've always shunned notoriety of any kind. As for Caroline, she's lived a very sheltered life, a very happy, peaceful life. Oh, did you notice the garden as you drove past?
I was quite impressed by it.
It's Caroline's garden. Mr. Prescott, tell me, could a garden that beautiful be tended by an unhappy girl?
Now, look, Mr. Bishop, I didn't say I thought she was unhappy.
No, but you suggested it. At least you gave me that impression.
Well, I didn't mean to. I'm just trying to find out all I can about your daughter.
All you need to know is that she's missing and that I want her back desperately.
Mr. Bishop, if I find your daughter and she refuses to come back, I'd have to let it go at that. I couldn't force her to do something against her wishes.
Why didn't you tell me this when I spoke to you on the phone?
Because you told me that your little girl was missing. I assumed she was a child.
Well, perhaps if I were to offer you a sizable bonus...
No.
Mr. Prescott, what are your conditions?
Well, if I find your daughter, I'll tell her that you're most anxious to have her back.
And if she says she won't return?
I'll contact you and give you all the information I have.
Including the address where she's staying?
If I have that information, yeah. But understand this, Mr. Bishop.
Yes?
The moment she tells me she doesn't want to return to you, that's when I drop the case. Now, if those conditions aren't satisfactory...
You leave me no alternative. Too much time has been lost already. All right, Mr. Prescott, I accept your conditions. But for the love of heaven, get moving.
Tickets. Tickets, please. Miss?
Hmm? Oh, I beg your pardon.
Ticket, please.
Oh, yes.
Well, the young lady's looking for her ticket conductor. Here's mine. There you are, sir. Thank you. Miss? Is something wrong?
I don't have a ticket.
Did you lose it?
No.
And if it's any help, conductor, I saw the young lady board the train at the last stop.
Yes, that was Baysville.
Where are you going, miss?
To the city.
I'll have to collect your fare. Let's see, Baysville to the city, that'll be $2.75.
Oh, mm-hmm.
$2.75, please.
Oh, yes, I have some money.
Ah, silver dollars, huh?
Here you are.
I'll have to give you some change. A quarter. Here you are.
Thank you.
Tickets. Tickets, please. I did that myself once.
Oh, were you speaking to me?
Yes, I said I did that myself once.
Oh.
Got on the train without a ticket, I mean.
I forgot about the ticket.
Yes, you seemed to be in quite a hurry when you boarded the train. I couldn't help noticing. I was looking through the window. My name's Jeff Tanner, by the way.
Oh, I'm Caroline Bishop.
Happy to know you. So you're going to the city?
Yes.
Yeah, so am I.
Oh, do you live in the city?
Well, I was born and raised there.
Oh, please tell me about it.
Haven't you ever been there?
No, but I've heard my people talk about it. And I've always wanted to go to the city. It must be very exciting.
Sometimes. I guess it's like most big cities. Just don't expect too much, and maybe you won't be disappointed. Incidentally, I know it's not my business, but...
Yes?
Those silver dollars in your purse...
Oh.
You don't often see silver dollars in this part of the country. You must have 50 of them.
63. That is, there were 63 before I paid my fare. I've been saving them. I received a dollar each week for tending the garden.
Well, I know of easier ways to get rich.
Well, it was just that...
I know. Look, you mustn't pay too much attention to what I say. I'm always making something out of nothing. That's my business.
Your business?
I'm a journalist.
Oh.
Some people are kind enough to call me a political expert.
My.
As a matter of fact, I've just been to the state capitol.
Huh?
I'm doing a series of articles on the Senate.
Your work must be very exciting.
Well, every now and then. But for the most part, it's a pretty boring business. Caroline, now, I'm going to ask a question that's absolutely none of my business. But, would you be staying with friends or relatives in the city?
No.
Then you've made a reservation at a hotel?
Well, no. I haven't made any plans.
Well, and I'm glad I asked. You see, this is the convention season, and every room in the better-known hotels has been booked. And some of the hotels that have available rooms, well, they're not the kind of places I'd recommend to a girl like you, believe me.
Well, what can I do?
If you'll let me, I'd like to help.
Oh, you are being very kind to me. And I'm grateful.
The fact is, I know a manager of a very nice little hotel that's only a short distance from the train station. I'm sure you're going to like it.
Oh, Jeff, it's a beautiful room. Thank you so much.
Well, not at all. I guess you're tired, huh?
Well, yes, I am.
Then I'll leave in just a moment, but I was wondering...
Yes?
You see, as an employed journalist, I have a certain amount of influence in this town. Just enough influence to get 2 tickets for the musical comedy at the Majestic Theater. It's sold out for almost a year in advance.
Oh.
Well, anyway, I was thinking... after you rest, maybe you'd like to see it with me.
Oh, I...
Of course, if you'd rather not, I'll understand.
Oh, no. No, Jeff, I'd love to go.
Well, fine. And maybe, if you like, we could have dinner before the show.
That'd be very nice.
Oh, great. Pick you up at 7?
All right.
Have a good rest, Caroline.
so glad you enjoyed the show.
Oh, I didn't think it was possible to laugh so much.
I didn't think laughter could sound so wonderful.
My, it's been a perfect evening. Dinner and the show and now this lovely little place.
You know something? Tonight, for the first time in my life, I really like this city.
Oh, Jeff.
No, I mean, I really like it. I even like the people.
Oh.
Carolyn, well, I don't know how long you're going to stay here, but please, don't leave without giving me fair warning, huh?
Jeff.
How long are you staying?
Please, don't let's talk about that.
But it's very important to me. I mean that.
Let's just think of now. Jeff.
What is it? Carolyn, what's wrong?
Jeff.
She's trembling.
That man near the door.
Well, what about him?
He's staring at me. Oh, Jeff, I'm afraid.
Do you know that man?
No.
Well, then why should you be afraid of him?
I don't know. Jeff, he's coming this way.
It's all right, Caroline.
Now, look, there's no need to get excited about this.
No one's going to get excited, not if you just move along and mind your own business.
I only want to have a few words with the young lady.
Who are you, and exactly what do you want? Now, make it quick.
All right, I was hired by this girl's father.
Jeff, please, take me out of here.
No, I'm out of Miss Bishop.
Don't touch me.
I only want...
My arm!
Let go of her. As soon as I've said my piece...
Jeff!
I said let go of her.
Now, look here, young
man. All right, you... Come on, Caroline, let's get out of here. No, it's all right, Caroline. It's all right. You're safe now.
That man. My father sent him. Oh, Jeff, I don't want to go back. Don't let them take me back, please.
Now, you don't have to go anywhere you don't want to go.
But you don't know my father. He never gives up. I was a prisoner in that big house. There were always walls around me. And then someone made a mistake. And the gate was left open. I didn't dare believe it. I thought that if I looked again, the gate would be locked. I packed some things and took the money I saved. And I went back to the gate and it was still open. Oh, you can't imagine how it felt to be able to leave that place.
Caroline, why did your father do this to you?
He didn't want me to see the outside world. I remember once he said the world was cruel. And so were the people in it. He said his duty was to protect me from the world.
Oh, no normal man acts like that.
He isn't an ordinary man, Jeff. He always gets what he wants.
No, not this time.
Oh. Oh, you're so good to me.
Because I care for you.
Oh, Jeff.
Well, why do you turn away? Caroline, what is it?
I'm afraid.
Afraid of my love?
Of my father. You just don't know him.
Well, now, look, he's a man. Not some kind of untouchable god, just a man. Now, all we have to do is go to the police.
No, you said you'd look after me.
I will.
Then take me away. Jeff, take me someplace where my father will never find me.
Caroline, that won't solve anything.
All I want is peace, can't you see? Don't you understand?
I'm trying to.
You don't know how it was. No one can know how it was.
Now, darling, trust me. Believe me when I say that I won't let anything happen to you. I love you.
Then take me away, Jeff. If you don't, I'll go by myself. I'm sorry, Jeff, but I mean it. Try to understand. I don't want to lose you, but I'm so afraid.
There's something that you're keeping from me.
I don't know what you mean.
Why are you so terribly afraid of your father?
I told you he kept me a prisoner.
Look, it has to go a lot deeper than that.
Please don't ask me any more questions.
I've got to. Now, darling, I want to help you, but I can't fight something unless I know what I'm fighting against. Now, if you've done something wrong, tell me.
I
don't care what it is, I'll stand by you.
I haven't done anything except to run away.
Why? What did you run away from?
Please don't ask me now. Please not now, Jeff.
Then you will tell me?
Yes. I promise that you'll know everything.
When?
Soon.
Oh, so you're the young man. Thank you for coming to see me. What's your name, please?
Didn't your private detective tell you?
He's no longer working for me. He said you refused my offer of $1,000.
That's right.
Oh, the young idealist, eh? You can't be reached with money, or perhaps I haven't gone high enough.
You're an old man, Mr. Bishop, so I'll forget you said that.
Tell me something, Mr. You know, a man as tough and as brave as you are shouldn't be afraid to give me his name.
It's Jeffrey Tanner.
All right, Mr. Tanner, let's not waste any more time. Exactly what do you want, or should I say, how much?
I came here expecting to dislike you, Mr. Bishop. I haven't been disappointed.
Where is my daughter?
Now, that's something I'm not prepared to tell you.
How much money do you want, Mr. Tanner? Don't bother bothering with me. Just tell me how much.
I think you really believe I came here to get some money from you.
There's nothing else for me to believe.
Well, have you considered the possibility that I might be in love with Caroline?
In love?
Or have you gone so sour on the world that you don't believe such a thing could happen?
No. How did you meet my daughter?
If you must know, we met on a train.
When?
Yesterday.
When did you see her last?
About 8 hours ago.
How was she?
Fine. Except for one thing. She's terrified of you. What did you do to her?
No. She's not afraid of me.
I'm certainly not going to take your word.
Oh, I don't doubt that she told you that she was afraid of me. I don't even doubt that she believes it.
What's that supposed to mean?
You don't know.
I don't know what? What are you trying to say?
You are in love with her. Heaven help you.
What is this?
My boy, look. Look at that oil painting on the wall.
All right. So it's Caroline.
No, it's her mother. Caroline was only a child when that painting was done. My wife was a beautiful woman. But 2 years after she sat for that painting, you wouldn't have known her. She was an old woman. An old woman who cringed in corners.
Mr. Bishop, you probably have some reason for telling me all this.
I do, believe me. You see, Carolyn's mother died in a mental institution.
What?
When Carolyn was 6 years old, she began to show the same symptoms.
No. Oh, no, I won't believe it. You're lying. Look, I spoke with her for hours. She was intelligent. Her reactions were completely normal.
I know. That's what makes it so cruel. Every now and then she has periods of clarity. Sometimes they last for as long as 2 days, but never longer. She always reverts, always becomes a child again.
Now, it isn't true.
I'm sorry.
I won't let it be true.
There's nothing that can be done about it.
Well, there are doctors.
Oh, I've had her examined by the best specialists in the world. There's no hope. My boy, look at me. You call me an old man. I'm only 45. Look into my eyes. How much suffering do you see there? You've loved her since yesterday. I've loved her for almost half my life.
Caroline.
You must believe me.
But she said she was afraid of you.
No, no, she doesn't really know what she's afraid of, but I do. I know what happens each time she reverts back. I've seen it so many times. If she's in a strange place, she knows nothing but stark terror, Mr. Tanner. Oh, you can't let that happen. Not if you love her. Caroline, dear, this gentleman has come to see you.
Oh.
Hello, Caroline.
Good morning, sir. Do you like my garden?
Yes, it's very lovely.
I'd give you a flower, but when you cut them, they die. I'm sure you wouldn't want that to happen.
No, I wouldn't.
You can pick out a favorite, and I'll keep it for you. Would you like to walk with me through the garden?
I'm sorry, I really must be going. Goodbye, Caroline.
Goodbye, sir. Oh, my. It's so strange.
What is, darling?
That gentleman's face, I remember it. Almost as if I saw him in a dream.
Yes, darling. You saw him in a dream.
Presented The Captive Spirit, written by Don Herring and directed by Warren Somerville. In the cast, Paul McGrath, Joan Loring, Ian Martin, Stan Watt, and Yaphet Kotto. Audio engineer, Marty Folia. Sound technician, Terry Ross. Script editor, Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Alexander Vlastotsenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. Executive producer for Theater 5, Edward A. Byron. We invite your comments. Write to Theater 5, New York 23, New York. This is Fred Foy speaking. Has been an ABC Radio Network production.
The favorite locale of writers of romantic adventure from Dumas to Sabatini has always been the Wayside Tavern. One of their favorite periods has been the Napoleonic era, and the same locale and the same historical period provide one of the most baffling true stories in all the chronicles of the strange and incredible.
The coach that sped along the road from Vienna that crisp wintry morning in November 1808 carried Benjamin Bathurst, ambassador from England to the court of Francis I, Emperor of Austria. At the moment, the eminent Mr. Bathurst was highly impatient, for he was returning to London with a report on weighty matters of state. His secretary, who sat beside him in the coach, listened patiently to his complaints.
What's the matter with the blasted creature's bother?
I'm afraid we need fresh horses, sir.
Well, then, let's get fresh horses. We'll find the nearest inn and change horses there.
Later, the English diplomat was comfortably ensconced in the inn. He had scarcely finished his third mug of ale when his secretary approached the table.
The horses are harnessed, sir.
Very well. I'll go out and look them over. Settle my account with the host, Palmer.
Having paid for the beer, the secretary followed his employer out onto the street in front of the inn. He found Mr. Bathurst examining the horses with a critical eye.
This one will do. Wait here. I want to take a look at the other one.
The ambassador stepped in front of the horses and disappeared on the other side of them. Palmer opened the coach door and glanced in to be sure that the luggage was safe. No sound came from the other side of the coach.
Anything the matter, sir? Mr. Bathurst.
The secretary hastened around to the other side of the carriage to see what had happened to his employer.
He's not here.
Palmer could see for several blocks in either direction. There was no one in view. He threw open the door of the coach again. It was empty. He ran into the inn and made inquiries, but mine host assured him that Mr. Bathurst had not come back into the inn. Two other patrons, sitting at a table near the window, informed Palmer that they, too, had seen the diplomat walk around in front of the horses, but that he had not reappeared. The secretary, in a state of utter bewilderment, sat down to wait for his employer's return. But Benjamin Bathurst did not come back. In fact, that was the last time he was ever seen. A single footnote needs to be added to this strange story. On January 23rd, 1810, more than a year after the British ambassador's sudden disappearance, a small and inconspicuous item appeared in a Hamburg newspaper.
Mr. Benjamin Bathurst, former British minister to the court of our emperor, has at last been found. His secretary, Mr. George Palmer, announced recently that he had received a letter from Bathurst himself informing him that he is safe and in good health.
In time, this item fell into Palmer's hands.
There's not a word of truth in it. I received no letter from Mr. Bathurst.
The theory has been advanced that Benjamin Bathurst was abducted by political enemies and that the item was inserted to bring to a halt the widespread search for him. Napoleon Bonaparte himself felt obliged publicly to disclaim any hand in the affair. But such a disclaimer was scarcely necessary. For after all, how can a man be abducted in broad daylight in the middle of the main street of a village while three eyewitnesses remain in complete ignorance of what is taking place? No, such a simple and logical explanation will not do. And until a better one is found, the case of Benjamin Bathurst must remain a mystery incredible but true.
Is far more desired for witness in the play of the druids than are all the circles of moon fantasy in the forests of moon mist lore. In the fog of the subconscious, there hang great and entwining branches that point strange fingers toward you and seem to whisper in the midnight breeze, "Art thou a doubter of my work?" You will hear the story of such in a moment when Theodore Osborne creates the role of Edgar Allan Poe in the story of The Solitary Genius, a man surfeited with a black and morbid and horrible obsession. Was again the blind poet Homer, who said, "Genius is a state between heaven and hell, and he who shall there reside will neither be understood nor yet have mundane understanding. He will never be forgiven, nor will he heed sup forgiving. He shall always stand solitary and alone, to be scorned yet have no wit for scorning." Such was the precarious estate of the tragic Edgar Allan Poe. Within the whirls and convolutions of his brain, there sprang dazzling flashes of the pure white light of fantasy. And betimes, in contrast, there formed eddies and whirlpools and turgid thoughts of black despair and melancholia. He was a man within himself, a man neither understood nor understanding. That is, with but one exception, there was but one beautiful and ethereal light of his existence, the light he immortalized forever and eternal in the sweet and pathetic lyrics of Annabel Lee. That was the celestial name he gave to her. Of course, her earthly name was Virginia Clemm.
Wondering where you were.
If your wonderment can inspire such music, then I beg of you to continue your wonderment, my dear.
Oh,
no, please, don't stop playing. That melody of yours fills this room of our little house until it becomes as the marble halls of Ire.
How many times have I told you about flattery turning my head?
Do you suppose flattery might turn your head sufficiently for me to kiss your lips?
Oh, my dear, it's just so silly and so wonderful. And I love you so.
Oh, dearest.
Thank you.
You know, Virginia, if love were the only coin of the realm, none could be as wealthy as we. And I would buy you gowns of lace, jewels of the most priceless, and you should live in a palace of Italian marble with 40,001 servants to do your bidding.
Oh, which reminds me, Edgar, the butcher called today asking again about his bill. He threatened to cut off our credit.
Oh, if I were only St. George and that infernal butcher a dragon, how I would thoroughly enjoy skewering him upon my spear and... What did you tell him?
Well, that I could tell him. Tomorrow, perhaps the next day, perhaps the day after. I had no money in the house, you know.
Yes, I know.
I wonder why poets must always be forced to starve, freeze, and eat cheese and get it like a monk.
Oh, we shan't always starve and freeze, Edgar. Someday you'll be famous. Oh, I just know it. I'm sure of it.
Yes, you're as sure of it as you are of tomorrow's breakfast.
But, darling, there's no need to become disheartened. There's no reason for us to be unhappy and discouraged. Why, Edgar, look what we have that the others haven't.
Yes, mildewed linen, moldy bread. And a shack over our heads that even cattle would be disgraced.
We have love, my dearest. And freedom.
Freedom?
Yes. Look, Edgar.
At what?
That bird sitting on that old stump out there. I think it's a raven, isn't it?
Yes.
On the surface, his life is black and ugly, but his soul is free. Oh, the spaces of the heavens belong to him. He can fly under the sun.
But I'll bet he can't write poetry.
No, he can't. But you can. His wings give him flight. But your poetry gives you flight that shall last beyond the life of, oh, that silly old bird.
Yes. Perhaps.
Beyond your life, Edgar, you shall live. And beyond his life, there will be nothing. Your life, our lives, but they shall be forevermore. And his life shall be nevermore.
Nevermore, quoth the raven. Nevermore. Virginia, excuse me. I'm going to my room.
You're going to your room?
Yes, to my room. And Virginia, don't disturb me. The raven is going to quote nevermore. And Edgar Allan Poe, in that one word, I promise you, shall live forevermore.
In the frenzy of inspiration, Edgar went to his room, sat at his desk, and pondered, head in hands, just how he should plan this poem. He did it all rationally, with sober reason. Not in abandoned drunken madness, as it has been said. His was the frenzy which all poets know, the poetic frenzy of inspiration that drove him on and held his thoughts to their purpose. Thus it was that he planned first the length, then the impression and tone of the poem, planned the refrain, and finally he wrote the last part first, so that he would have some definite entity toward which to build. In this way, Edgar Allan Poe worked in that poor, cheap little house, and so grew those 108 lines of mournful and never-ending remembrance, The Raven.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary
over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while he nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came...
Is some visitor tapping at my chamber door? Only this, and nothing more.
It was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Vainly he had sought to borrow from his books surcease of sorrow. Sorrow for the lost Lenore, of the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. But presently his soul grew stronger, and hesitating then no longer, he opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. And the only word there spoken was the whispered word,
Lenore?
This he whispered, and an echo murmured back the word,
Lenore.
Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all his soul within him burning, soon again he heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. Open here, he flung the shutter. When with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. And perched upon the chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more.
Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou art sure no craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, from the nightly shore.
Then quoth the raven... Much he marveled, this ungainly fowl, to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. But the raven, sitting lonely upon the door, spoke only that one word.
Prophet raven,
compel this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden, whom the angels name Lenore.
Quoth the raven,
but that word our sign of parting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door.
Then quoth the raven, and the raven, never flitting, still is sitting just above the chamber door, and his eyes have all the meaning of a demon that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor, and the soul from out that shadow shall be lifted.
Fortune, my dear. No more moldy bread and cheese that even the mice refuse. Oh, Virginia, my dearest, we're rich and we're... Oh.
What's the matter, Edgar? Darling, what is it? Didn't they buy it after all?
Yes, Virginia. They bought it. Listen.
Yes?
For all rights, privileges, publications, and copies for your poem, The Raven. Please find enclosed check in the amount of $10, Virginia. We are rich indeed. Nevermore.
The beautiful Annabel Lee. The sweet chime of music that was to Edgar Allan Poe the very essence of life, died out upon the morning air, and there by the wild sea pounding, and in the presence of heaven's angels, he buried her. Then his footsteps turned, and a predestined track led him on to a new and strange experience. In the ancient scroll, it is written that the angel Israfel gives to his chosen only once in 10,000 years the power of vision into the future. Edgar Allan Poe, the chosen of this angel, had caught that prophetic crystal from the realms above, had held it, guarded it in his heart, and now he stands without the portals of the strange and foreboding house of Roderick Usher. In his own words, hear him tell in the flash of genius the most startling narrative that mortal ear has ever caught. As I approached the ancient domain of Usher, I sensed a peculiar atmosphere, one which had no affinity to the air of heaven, but which reached up from the decayed trees and the gray walls and the silent tarn, a pestilent and mystic vapor, dull, sluggish, faintly discernible, and leaden-hued. And I became aware of a great fracture, or crack, which, extending from the roof of the building in front, made its way down the wall in a zigzag direction until it became lost in the sullen waters of the tarn. I crossed the heavy bridge of the moat and went, filled with that ominous feeling, to the ancient portal of the house of Christ. My friend, Roderick Usher. I wish shelter and warmth. Tell your master that an old friend has come to call, that his name is Edgar Allan Poe.
Very well. You may come in. You will wait here in the hall while I inform Mr. Usher of your arrival.
As the cadaverous servant disappeared into the gloom of the long, vaulted corridor, my gaze wandered to the tomb-like structure of my surroundings. I say tomb-like only to describe the decaying furnishings and architecture in which I felt strangely confined. Ancestral portraits hung loosely and dull within cracked, cobwebbed frames. Grinning masks of armor peered out from the shadows. A great circular staircase wound and coiled like some black, ugly serpent into the reaches of the room.
Poe! Edgar Allan Poe!
Roderick!
Upon my life, I've never been so surprised. Let me look at you. It is you, isn't it? It is Edgar Allan Poe, not some specter come to haunt these halls of Usher.
It is truly I, Roderick. And I think it is only weariness, hunger and cold, which lend me this specter's mask. I hope I haven't intruded.
Intruded, my good man. Let me say that no visitor to this house has ever been more welcome than yourself. Oh, but come, we'll not stand here in the draught of the hall. We'll repair to the warmth and comfort of my studio. Will you allow me to lead the way, my friend Edgar Allan Poe? Now, if you will comfort yourself with the fire, in the great chair, we'll talk. And I think we have much to say, haven't we?
You have much, and I have little. But tell me, Roderick, how's it been? Have you been well?
Since you've asked, I can only tell you the truth, Edgar. I trust it shan't frighten you or disturb your visit. I fear that I am falling heir to the same sickness which has held my sister in its bondage.
Are you speaking of Madeline? Do you mean to tell me that she's ill?
Oh, yes.
But I can't conceive of illness striking such beauty of both body and soul as is Madeline. The Madeline that I knew.
Life is a strange thing, Edgar. Will you excuse me, please? Yes, come in. Well, Philip, what is it?
I beg your forgiveness for this intrusion, sir.
Yes, yes.
I have just returned from the room of the Lady Madeline, sir.
She is worse? She wants me to come to her?
No, sir. I beg to inform you, sir, that the Lady Madeline is dead.
Ladies and gentlemen, as the lips of the servant of Usher pronounced the dread words, the Lady Madeline is dead. Slowly the great ancestral clock ticked, devouring the minutes and hours that passed in morbid reverie. The bells of the tower still swayed in their half-crazed dance, and I found myself standing with Roderick Usher within the subterranean copper-lined vault that was now the tomb of his lovely sister, the Lady Madeline. Roderick. Roderick.
Yes.
Will you not leave her side now? To gaze upon death too long, my friend, is destructive to the soul of the living.
Yes, I know. But Edgar, I can't believe it. Somehow my mind refuses to accept the truth. This is my sister.
No, Roderick. This was your sister.
Edgar, please.
Look at me, Roderick, and listen. Life is the end. Death is the start. And only through death may life begin. The survival constructive value of this life is the only medium through which man, civilization, empires may achieve the ultimate of perfection. In the fulfillment of the two cardinal laws of God, birth and death, do we only see beauty in its most perfect form. All things must end, Roderick, before they can begin. And not as consolation, not as condolence, do I say to you that death is the life of everlasting peace and triumph, that before the dawn of that perfect era of creation shall break, before we stupid infinitesimal minutiae of commonplace episodes shall find the perfect karma of achievement, peace without war,
A metamorphosis of death must decay this flesh of the lust and germinate the cell of new life that shall be forever without the pallor of death.
But, Edgar, surely...
These things I know, Roderick. How I know? Why? But I do know them. As surely as I know that as man shall die, so shall civilization. That as the selfish forms of social organization shall fall, so also shall fall the house of Usher. And then, Roderick, then will come the miracle of birth and the phenomenon of everlasting life.
The days wear on, and Roderick Usher, last of the symbolic line that reaches far back into the history of civilization, sinks deeper into his morbid shell. Only his music, the strange, half-mad innuendo of sound that seems to emanate from the depths of his soul, continues on through the murky nights and lurid days to console him. Then, knowing that human companionship alone can hope to break this introverted mania, Edgar Allan Poe breaks in upon the solitary Usher and diverts him from his vigil of lone sorrow.
Roderick. Roderick. Yes. You must stop this. You must put an end to this means of self-torture, Roderick. If you don't, you shall go mad. And I shall go mad. Body and soul can't stand it.
Edgar.
Yes.
Edgar. My sister is dead.
And your sister's brother shall also become dead if you don't cease this vigil of wanton self-effacement.
Have you ever heard the voices of silence? Have you ever listened to the words of condemnation echoing from the shadowed corners, from rooms, from hallways? No.
Roderick, don't give way to hysteria.
This is no hysteria. No, I'm not mad, not insane. The voices I've heard were not the mumblings of imagination. I tell you, Edgar Poe, they were real, repeating the same words over and over.
What words?
She is not dead. She is buried alive.
In the name of God, Roderick.
No, wait, wait, Poe. Listen. I hear nothing, Edgar Poe. Look as I am looking. See as I am seeing. And if your eyes do not see as mine, then I am truly bereft of reason. Mad, insane.
The door.
Madeline.
Oh, God, the Father, Christ, the...
Madeline.
Roderick. Why have you done this to me? Oh. Madeline. Madeline!
The body of Roderick Usher fell with a mad shuddering upon the now lifeless corpse of his serum and enfolded sister. From that chamber and from that mansion I fled aghast. And suddenly there shot along the path a wild light. And while I gazed, the crack in the castle rapidly widened. My brain reeled as I saw the mighty walls rushing asunder. And there came then, through the brilliance that can come only from catastrophe, a strange and perplexing sight of things to come.
I've been listening to Obsession.
That's going to do it for the show this week. I hope you enjoyed our selections this time around. Find more old-time radio at relicradio.com, along with everything else Relic Radio. Links to our Facebook page, Twitter, Shoutcast stream, forum, everything Relic Radio can be found there. Also find a donate button if you'd like to help support this and all the Relic Radio shows, and a huge thank you to those who have. You can email me at relicradio@gmail.com. I'll be back next Tuesday with another 60 minutes of old-time radio on the Relic Radio Show.